I may think I'm Canadian and inherently and consciously do the things that a Canadian is supposed to do. But if you took one look at me, none of that would matter. Why is that? I forgot to add the most important element of Canadian identity. You must be white.
Christopher Stewart different diaspora groups. Racism did not make Maroons and African Americans a homogeneous.
Canadian identity, such as it is, defines itself primarily in opposition to the United States.
A sign that it feels itself to be mortal. A sign that it feels itself to be a corpse. Aimé Césaire.
The only way I could have come to Canada to work was as a domestic servant. Yvonne Brown.
It's embarrassing discovery.
Their lives are already destroyed.
As Canadians, we'd like to think of the fact that these oppressed people were escaping north into Canada, and they were running from the U.S. into Canada to gain their freedom. But in actual fact, between 1787 and 1833 was a time period when Upper Canada had slavery. It was diminishing, but that we had slavery. Meanwhile, across the Detroit River in the Michigan Territory, in the what was then called the Northwest Territory, they had a law which also prohibited slavery. And so, in actual fact, in a way that the language just sounds wrong but is actually true, we had slaves in Canada, Canadian slaves, escaping south across the border into the U.S. to get their freedom, which just sounds reversed.
Wonder. Too often, that's what Canadians feel when they hear stories like this. Stories that place blackness in the history of Canada. Canada's national story is just that. A story. It has changed over time, but fundamentally, it's held together by the same general structure that was constructed as early as 1867. The only problem? It's not a very inclusive story. The story of Canada that has shaped our national identity is the story of white settlers. It is one story among millions, but it's the one that's heard over all the others. So maybe it's no surprise that a story about slaves running to Michigan seems strange. It just doesn't seem to fit with common sense. We are going to explore some stories today that complicate that common sense idea of Canada. These are the stories that help us define ourselves. They have power. They are voices that are rarely heard, that evoke that wonder. These are stories that surprise us. We are going to find out why that is today. How did the story of Canada come to be, and who wrote it? And how does that impact Black Canadians today? Beginning in 1867, there was a concerted effort put into carving out a national identity for Canada. It was an origin story, a story to distinguish Canada from Britain and the United States. But from its inception, it left out the histories of blacks in Canada, beginning with forgetting slavery in Canada to managing the stories of the diaspora today. We're going to begin in 1867, at the birth of a nation and its national story.
So the history of, and I want to talk specifically about English Canadian nationalism because there tends to be a difference there in between. Much of our imagining of Canada comes out of late 19th century and the imagining of the great white north. And when we think of whiteness in that way, we generally think of snow, right? But that imagination of the great white north came out of a very specific political and racial project called the Canada First Movement.
Canada got its independence from Britain in 1867, but many settlers still considered themselves British. Britain controlled Canadian immigration policies, could demand soldiers for war, and, you know, the king signed all the laws. The Enlightenment was in full swing in England at the time, and with it came some interesting ideas about geography and race. Peter Hodgins, a Canadian studies professor at Carleton University, can elaborate.
So in England, there was this, and Europe, there's this kind of social, environmental Darwinism, which argued that essentially the further north you were, the more virtuous and enterprising and able-bodied and so on you become, and the further south you go. The more decadent you become, the more lazy you become, and so on and so forth, right? So late 19th century, Britain is engaged in all these colonial wars. And there's the Boer War. They scoop up all the working class unemployed British young men, give them the state-of-the-art weapons, and they still get their kind of ass kicked by right? Because they were so unhealthy. And so there's this whole movement to send British working class to Canada as part of the, because they're going to this northern cold place, whiteness would then become remasculated. And then the cold, the ruggedness of Canada would create this sort of Norseman of the New World. So like the modern race of Vikings would then sort of be the head of the British Empire.
Now, you might agree with Hodgins when he says...
So it's a weird story.
But it's an important one in understanding why Black histories are excluded from the Canadian identity. I think it's a good time now to talk a bit about nationalism. Nationalism is a constructed narrative connecting country to its people. It is a way for people to identify themselves, and perhaps more importantly, a way for people to control our remembering of the past and dictate the future. In anthropology, group identity is often theorized as being formed in relation or in contrast to others. It is a complex balance of exclusion and inclusion, of choosing markers that identify the in-group and the out-group. These markers become common sense, and there are lots of markers of the Canadian identity, though it may not seem initially obvious. But through the Canada First movement, we can see that one of them is the construction of whiteness. For another, we can turn back to Peter Hodgins.
And the other story, one more story, is that one of the ways Canadian cultural nationalism takes from what's called anti-colonial nationalism. And so it's the assumption that, and often we see this in all kinds of countries, that the superpower, the colonizing power, might be a military superpower compared to us, might be an economic superpower, but we are a moral superpower. Right? So we project that onto the states, which are that way, not that way. So the story of the Underground Railroad becomes very important as an index of Canadian moral superiority. Right, so we were this refuge for slaves, and so the only reason blackness enters into the Canadian story at all, like we forget about the history of slavery in Canada, of which there was. We forget about the fact that when the people from the refugee slaves arrived in Canada, they were treated just as poorly as they were anywhere else. They were hardly welcomed with open arms. We forget all those things, right? So that when blackness enters into the Canadian imaginary, it's just to prove our moral superiority vis-a-vis the Americans, generally.
The construction of Canada into a moral superpower goes a long way in explaining why slavery has been selectively remembered and forgotten in the Canadian narrative. We don't want to look bad, but our next story is one of those forgotten ones that doesn't show Canada in the best light. Marie-Joseph Angélique was a slave in Montreal. She belonged to a wealthy family that lived near the St. Lawrence River. She was a domestic slave, which meant that she took care of various household chores. On April 10th, 1734, Angélique allegedly set her master's house ablaze, taking the entire city of Montreal with it. Her master had died, and his wife intended to sell her, which was allegedly the reason why she set the fire. Though she ran away, she was eventually caught, tortured, and in the end, hanged. There are a few different ways the story of Marie-Joseph could be framed. Setting fire to her master's house could be framed as a form of resistance, a stand against slavery, a courageous act of agency. Of course, at the time, that's not how it was framed. Angélique was paraded throughout the city, her body burned after it was hanged. She had threatened the power of white Montrealers by making herself a part of the city's history. Her physical presence needed to be erased from the people's memory. all part of casting her outside the Canadian story. According to Dr. Catherine McKittrick, a professor of gender studies at Queen's, there are only a few stories about her and only one extensive history about her life. Her story belongs to the counter-narrative of Canadian history, not the official one. Since the Canada First movement was built on racist notions of white superiority, it stands to reason that Eurocentric ways of remembering, through written documentation, would be privileged in constructing Canada's past. So for those who couldn't read or write, their histories are largely invisible. And even when there was written documentation, it was the job of archivists and historians of the time to decide which documents were worth keeping and which were not. Archivists and historians who, in the 19th century, were uniformly male and white.
This particular archive of letters had been forgotten about when she left Canada in 1863. And it just sat there in the house until 1974, and people forgot that it was there, to the extent that in 1974, they actually, her descendants who then owned the house, knocked the house down with a bulldozer. And it wasn't really until after it was just a pile of lumber on the ground that they were about to put a match to that they suddenly noticed a letter and then started hunting and found more letters. And so it was this was the feature that I was interested in.
Alison Smith is a master's student at Carleton, making a documentary about Mary Ann Shadd, an activist, businesswoman, and abolitionist who came to Canada in 1851 after the passing of the Fugitive Slave Act in the U.S. in 1850 that made escaped slaves vulnerable to re-enslavement, even if they had made it to the free states in the North. Shadd owned a newspaper. She fought to end segregation in Canada, and she encouraged people to move to Canada. For a time, she fully believed that Canada was a safe haven for blacks.
Mary Ann definitely saw Canada as being a safe haven. And I think, coming from the outside, having just moved to Canada, and just, in fact, the first time around, she just was visiting Canada. She came to a convention in Toronto. But she... You know, as she came to know Canada better and have lived here, I think she came to realize that it wasn't perfect. I mean, her initial sense of the place was that it was a safe haven. And in fact, for somebody who was coming from slavery, Canada would be such a better place to be. But of course, once you've lived here for a while and you've gotten to be accustomed to your safety. Safety from slavery, then you start to see the sort of more societal problems with racism and exclusion and segregation and things like that, treatment of by your neighbors.
Remember when Peter Hodgins talked about Canada framing itself to be morally superior to the United States? Well, one of the ways this was done was to create the North Star myth. Canada as a refuge for escaped African Americans, where they could be free and equal. Mary Ann Shadd fell for the myth, but as we can see, her relationship with Canada became complicated the longer she stayed. Her understanding of the Canadian story changed as she experienced discrimination and racism. She quickly realized she wasn't meant to be a character in the Canadian story.
Initially, she went back because she was asked to come back during the American Civil War to recruit black soldiers to fight in the war. So she went back for a job. Basically. But it was also, I mean, she and her whole family had been a family of abolitionists down in Delaware and in Pennsylvania, and her parents had been abolitionists, and she was raised to be an abolitionist. So when the Civil War came along, I mean, they didn't know how this was going to end. It could have ended differently. Mm-hmm. They didn't know, and nobody knew. So she went back because in the middle of the war, the government decided that they were going to allow black soldiers to form regiments, and they needed to find black soldiers who were willing to sign up to fight. And so some came from Canada, but they wanted to get more from each of the states, and Mary Ann was asked to go back to drum up support and look for people who'd be willing to come and fight.
In discussing slavery in the Canadian context, black people are often viewed as simply passing through our borders, as transient or temporary. While Shad may have gone back to the States, she built a life in Canada, married a Black Canadian man. Her story is more complex than our common sense narrative leads us to believe. And her narrative is only complicated through those salvaged letters Smith was lucky enough to get her hands on.
The archives would say, archivists would say, that people didn't offer their history, or that they didn't make it available, they didn't think it was important, they didn't maybe save their history, they didn't write it down, or they didn't save it, or they didn't have a way to save it. So some of these things definitely, you know, came into play. But there was also, I think, an element of what the archives were interested in collecting and what they wanted and what they thought was valuable. So trying to figure out what they thought might be interesting to future generations.
So even if you wanted to tell a story about Black people in Canada, to counter that official narrative, it would take a lot of digging. Sometimes it will be impossible.
I remember it was grade 10, and we were told to talk about our family history. I guess it was our first big project. And when I started talking about Sarah Colley, and I did some research, and there were some documents on the website, like different archives of Canada, and then from hearing different stories, I was able to piece my project together. We found out that she was sent from Jamaica to Nova Scotia, but still trying to find what part of Africa she came from. And her main story is that what we know about Sarah Colley is that she worked for George Wentworth Colley, which was the governor of Nova Scotia. And so she worked for him for a little while, and they had children together, although she was what you call the mistress in those days. And that's where we kind of developed the name Colley, which Colley isn't our original last name.
That's Jesslyn Colley, a fourth-year student at Carleton University, who has been tracing her family's history since she was 16 years old.
I guess documents are somewhat there, but somewhat lost, and especially over time when people were traded, they were... I know some, especially in the Caribbean, I think they kept a really good record, but when people came to Canada, I guess the records really did get kind of mixed up, so that could be the case. And
the loss of documentation for Sarah Colley is all part of the process of selective forgetting. The official Canadian story is a story built around ideas of superiority, of racism, and of power. And it is in the best interests of those who are represented in that official story that the Great White North is what's remembered, while Sarah Colley is forgotten. Identity, how we think about ourselves, the markers we make to both exclude and include people, is not static. It changes and adapts as time goes on. This is inevitable. What doesn't change dies out pretty quickly. In the case of a national identity, if it doesn't adapt to the changes of what is socially acceptable and what's not, then that identity loses relevance, and that story is dropped for another one. The Canadian narrative, that began in earnest in 1867, has also adapted and changed to be more socially acceptable in our present discourses around race and the nation.
So this notion of Canada as a white place becomes very central to the imagination of English Canada, and it gets enshrined in things like immigration policy. And so it comes out of this weird racist model of, you know, the further north you are, and generally the whiter, but the more so if people come from the south, they won't contribute to the economy, they will do crime and all these things. Recently in the news, there was something about the most Canadian picture of all, photo of all time. It was a Mountie playing hockey in the Red Surge, the Mountie Stetson, in front of Banff. So that was, especially the Toronto Sun and things, called this the most Canadian photo of all time, and which should speak to the way in which that still is this model of whiteness, but it was very powerful. And so this guy playing hockey in front of Banff, there's a whole, and we see this in Tim Hortons commercials, we see that whole imaginary is still very powerful.
I want to pause here for a second and acknowledge that, well, we've just jumped over a huge amount of history. So I don't want to suggest that there weren't any waves of black immigration to Canada between Confederation and present day. There were plenty. There are so many stories, in fact, that we just don't have time to cover them all. But one thing I want to stress. All of them dealt with that dominant storyline of Canada as white and blacks as either non-existent or anomalies in the story. Okay, now let's get back to it. While that model of whiteness, as Peter Hodgins calls it, is still very powerful, Canada's story has also adapted. Instead of the North Star myth, we have the story of Canada as a multicultural nation, a place where everyone is welcome to perform their cultural identity with no interference.
What multiculturalism does is that, and I hate that I have to say this, allows me to celebrate another culture in the way that we choose. And so it means being able to speak more than one language and be able to speak more than one language in white spaces and not to feel any ways about it. I mean, people will look at us, but there's no law preventing us to do so. Multiculturalism allows me to celebrate Guinean independence in, again, spaces that are, you know, institutions like our university, you know what I mean, and do so freely. Multiculturalism, especially in Toronto, allows me to be a very proud Ghanaian with a flag on my car during World Cup season. And so I like that because, you know, there's this, like, climate in the environment that says, yes, be proud to be connected to another country, you know what I mean? Do so, you know, yes, we're, look at this cultural mosaic, I guess. Is that the right term to use? Right. So, I don't know. I think, yeah, that's what multiculturalism allows me to do. And I'm happy with that.
Meet Debbie. She's a Carleton student from Toronto. And she, as you heard, is a beneficiary of the story of multiculturalism. But looking critically at the story of multiculturalism, we can ask ourselves, who's writing it? Who created the story of multiculturalism and who controls it?
I hate saying this because that idea of multiculturalism being a facade and that, again, being allowed to, who is responsible for creating this idea of multiculturalism? We got to look at, like, our government and, like, the nation of Canada, and, like, they create this idea of multiculturalism just for face value, and they get to pick and choose what they like. That's another, when I say allow, because another part of it, too, it's not like I'm allowed to... I don't know, be a socialist. We have Ghanaian history is very much tied to, like, parts of socialism. And so that's a part, I guess, Canada would not allow, because everything else is good. The food and everything else that's pretty. But that type of stuff wouldn't be allowed. Yeah.
So Debbie's story is only allowed in the Canadian context so long as it fits with that official story. Canada as a safe haven. Maybe a North Star for people from all over the world, rather than from just the States. Groups who live in Canada, who are first or second generation Canadians, who identify with their home story before the Canadian one. Now, they can tell their story, but only in certain spaces, at certain times.
Yeah, it's interesting, because, like, I think of, like, when you're in, like, elementary school and you have, like, those multicultural days, and it's almost like, expected, because you're so different, to come here and show us why you're so different, you know what I mean? And it's just like, I'm existing, you know what I mean? Is that not different enough? And it's almost like we have to put up this show, but who is it really for? Is it for us, or is it for everyone else to, like, look at, you know? So it's interesting. Also, too, when they say that, like, you can see how, like, political leaders use that. Well, you're allowed to do certain things here, you know what I mean? Like, we're not as bad as the next country, even though they're still complicit in all the stuff that bad country is still doing, right? So it's just funny how they use multiculturalism as an excuse to get away with things.
Multiculturalism is presented as common sense in Canada. How it works in reality is more complicated. Debbie uses her own agency to both use the story of multiculturalism and critique it. She knows how far she can go before her story is forgotten as well. Terms like multicultural and diverse were only recently incorporated into the official Canadian narrative, even though, as we've seen, there have been many diverse groups in Canada for a long time. Part of the historical forgetting of black people in Canada is the presumption of blackness as a recent phenomenon. Blackness is coded to mean immigrant, suggesting difference from the Canadian national identity, but it offers little space for nuance within that immigrant status. Your identity can't change over time.
Well, within the black diaspora, I think, yes, multiculturalism offers us something useful, right? It puts into public discourse and allows for spaces of cultural identity and processes of identification, right? Mm-hmm. However frozen or stereotyped some of these representations may be under multiculturalism, right? But I see multiculturalism as doing a couple different things, right? It freezes difference. While at the same time that it opens up these spaces where groups can come together, like newcomers and mm-hmm. different immigrant groups and people identifying by nationality, at that very moment, it also freezes their differences so that they can never be hyphenated. They could never be, you know, pre-war Somalis and post-war Somalis. They're always going to be the same thing.
To Mark Campbell, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Regina, multiculturalism is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's a tool the diaspora can use to perform cultural identities, to unite, to be visible. On the other, these stories are being selectively remembered. They are snapshots of identity, static and unchanging.
Many of the rewards of the state forces them then to either identify as black or perform, you know, what is understood as African or black identity and culture. And rewarding you for performing the static, right? As opposed to recognizing that if you are, you know, say, for instance, you're Ghanaian and you're Trinidadian, that you live through two different languages, two different worlds, you know, your identity is hybridized, and you may, you know, all of those pieces just get lost, and they necessarily have to be lost for, you know, the state to be able to fund your project or to understand you on a census form.
Campbell uses the term Afro-diasporic to describe the many groups and many waves of black immigration to Canada, all the way back to the slaves whose transatlantic journey began in the 17th century. Afro-diaspora is used to describe that heterogeneity as a form of resistance against the simple story multiculturalism cultivates. It is also a way of remembering those groups of people in the past who are forgotten in the Canadian narrative. In many ways, the impact of those forgotten stories is that present Afro-diaspora groups also remain outside the Canadian narrative. They have had to find spaces to tell their own stories outside the official one.
Pain, pleasure, frustration, anger, not all of them are always allowed to be demonstrated in Canadian society. But I would say that the outsideness becomes a space of articulation and enunciation, right? It becomes a place where the creative takes over and people find ways to make this place work for them and make it home.
For Campbell, this creative space is music.
For, you know, maybe 200 years, any African that came to this side of the world was not allowed to learn how to read. And when you're not allowed to learn how to read, when it becomes illegal, when your life is in danger for learning how to read, you develop other ways of communicating, other ways of expressing oneself. And the drum and the turntable and the steel pan, all of these things have been mechanisms in which, you know, Africans in the Western world have found ways to articulate joy, pain, pleasure, to communicate across, you know, vast regions, to rebel, to celebrate, all of those pieces. And that's why I spend time there.
Make everyday progress, just dealing with life's tech and everyday process. Ayo, we strive to conquer.
Right, there's only so many written documents we can find, and privileging a written word reinscribes us within Eurocentric thought, right? So I do start with sound as a territory in which to understand black life.
Those forgotten stories don't only impact those groups who came to Canada when multiculturalism was added to the Canadian story. Carmen Poole, a doctoral candidate at the University of Toronto, has found in her own research on blacks in Chatham, Ontario, that it means there's little interest in learning their own histories. They are used to believing that black stories in Canada are not important.
At the Black Historical Society, you would have bus trips, tours of old Americans, and you would have, you know, white Americans coming over, just, you know, perusing and driving around and coming in to see the museum. But none of the content in the museum is actually used in any of the schools in the city. And, you know, a good number of black people from Chatham have never been in there. So it's I think it's probably a question of relevance, you know. I think this is a bigger question about historical consciousness in Canada and how we teach it and how we learn it. And as, you know, regardless of race, it's just, it's like a hobby, right? Like, I'm just not significant in terms of my lived, you know, my day-to-day experiences, and some people are interested in it and some people aren't interested in it. And I don't think it's easy to teach significance. But we always found it quite startling that it was interesting, because then there's the question of whether or not individuals related to it or saw themselves in it. And I basically tie that to the fact that if you didn't learn it in school and you were underrepresented in the content and in the curriculum, then the disengagement is, you know, obviously going to be a little bit greater. And as you grow into your adult, like, I mean, what would bring you back to it?
In her work in Chatham, Poole found that people didn't want to know their histories. They had accepted that official Canadian narrative, accepted that they would never really belong to it.
It was let sleeping dogs lie. Like, absolutely, that's, let it go. It's, let it go. Like, and, you know, why is it important? And sort of debating the merits of asking in the first place. I think for some people it might have been, some of the older individuals, there was some skepticism as to, you know, why and why now? Why me? You know, if you've never been asked your opinion or your life history and you're just a regular individual who, you know, worked at the shop for the last 40 years, why is there sudden interest in my life experience? Just not understanding it from that perspective. But one of the gentlemen I interviewed, it wasn't so much let sleeping dogs lie, as it was, we don't talk about that. And he's like, basically, when your mom said that, you just stopped the line of inquiry, right? You know, and the same thing happened when, you know, you had people in Chatham who passed and would move to St. Thomas or London or Oshawa and pass as white. I mean, obviously nobody's going to talk about that.
The official story of Canada, it seems, was overpowering in the context of Poole's work. Blacks in Chatham were such a small minority that they felt the only way to survive was to forget their histories, too.
You know, these different, they're not coping mechanisms so much as they are, I think you could almost go to the point of saying they're techniques, survival techniques, where I think it goes back to wearing the mask, you know, at the end of the day, and like you said, the double consciousness, where you do have to maintain a particular image.
Canadian history is often viewed as boring. Like Poole said, people don't see it as relevant to their everyday lives. But by looking at these stories that are produced by nations, by communities, by individuals, we can see not only that Canada has multiple histories, as opposed to a single national story, but that these histories have a profound effect on how blacks are seen and see themselves in Canada today.
We take as a given that history is a construct of sorts, and the fact that we have essentially constructed it where this particular identity doesn't make sense to anybody. Like, mm-hmm. You know, it just doesn't make sense. And so I'm like, okay, well, this is the problem. So it's not necessarily about where I'm from. It's about why you don't think I can be from here. Or why, you know, that you don't think I can be, but it's not expected, probably the best way to say it.
We've come back to that notion of wonder, of the unexpected. That wonder is still present in Canada today, wonder at blackness as part of the Canadian historical narrative. But what we know now is that that official story, the one that began with the Canada First movement and has morphed and changed into what we think of the Canadian identity, is just one facet of the story of Canada. So after hearing just a few of those stories that put black people as central characters in the stories of this country, how can we think about blackness in Canada?
It means, like, the world to me, because it meant having the privilege to be around Ghanaian people my entire life.
We have connections with the Mi'kmaq peoples and also cottage background mixed with African heritage, so it's very diverse and mixed.
Recognizing that identity is a state of becoming, right? Identity is always in flux.
The more research we do and the more we work together, you know, the more complex the discussion becomes.
I want to thank all the people that contributed to the making of this podcast. Peter Hodgins, Debbie Owusu-Achia, Jesslyn Colley, Mark Campbell, Allison Smith, and Carmen Poole. Today you also heard Jazz Exercise No. 3 by Oscar Peterson and Milonga del Angel by Astor Piazzolla, played by Ann Bowker. You also heard El Va au Japon by Nick Bomarito and We Strive by the Xing Xing Regime. My sincere thanks to the Class of History 3717 for participating in this project.